You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only...
Only.
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 Micro-broadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, and this is Steve Cato, and we are not in the K-Chung Studios.
No, we are socially distant from the K-Chung Studios. I'm in Austin, Texas.
And I am in Pasadena, California.
The gateway to Hill Country, and also the gateway to Hill Country. Yeah. How's it been? How's it been since last week's talking show?
You know, the days are up and down, but I feel like the last couple of days have been okay. Somehow the public addresses by the governor of California are helpful for me.
Does he do them every day?
No. I thought Garcetti was doing him at quite a clip for a minute there, but I lost track. But I guess the whole West Coast has formed a kind of conglomerate about how they're going to handle it.
Yeah, it's cool.
And yeah, it is nice. Which I suppose really means California is in charge of the West Coast.
Well, but all the rich people are in Washington. All the richest two of the richest men in the world live in Washington.
That's true. I wonder how it is these days, because they say that California is produces several times over the U.S.'s GDP, something like that. I forget.
No,
it's
a very large portion of the U.S. GDP.
Okay, the largest chunk. I wonder if Washington's catching up with Amazon and Microsoft and everything.
Well, I don't think it's. I think per capita, Washington's probably richer.
Yeah.
But it's just that there's so many more people in California.
That is true. And so many more industries, I suppose.
Yeah.
They don't make movies up there.
Amazon Studios. but you know, they have Amazon and Starbucks and Microsoft and all these Boeing, all these jumbo.
The Rock and Roll Museum.
The very stupid museum. Yeah. So they have a lot of giant industries there that, you know, we do have aerospace and we do have tech and such, but you know, at the end of this crisis, Amazon will be America's only retailer.
Yeah. Or the U.S. will just be rebranded as Amazon or something.
Yeah. Something like that. And so the concentration of power. And Starbucks is literally universal now as well. Yeah. So the sort of for some reason, you know, we have huge businesses here in California, but they produce only sort of monolithic entities. Costco is from Seattle. You know, mm-hmm. every monolith comes from Seattle or the greater Seattle area. And then we have just big stuff comes from here. But Facebook's big, you know, Google's big, but it's not everything.
Have you heard the episode of In Our Time about coffee?
Yeah,
that's
I
a
have.
Good one.
It was. I was a little disappointed. There were some things I wanted them to go more in. It was very Anglo-centric, didn't you think?
It's In Our Time. Basically the effects, the cultural effects of England.
Yeah, sure. Well, sure. But they would have, for example, the one on, what's his name? The famous Islamic mathematician from Iran, you know, in the mm-hmm. late Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, it'd be hard to only talk about England in that episode.
Right. And so they glossed over the entire first bit of the history of coffee and focused largely mm-hmm. on sort of Lloyd's of London and things like that, which believe me, it's fascinating. This is a minor quibble. I am not, I'm not beating up on the knowledgeable panel, etc. But they really just sort of just jump straight from coffee appeared in the Near East to
Steve Cato's Corona project is to decolonize coffee podcasts.
Well, no, you know, it's I felt they gave it very short shrift. They introduced the topic and then just left, you know? And I mm-hmm. wanted a little more, because to me, that's a very mysterious part of it. And I guess Do you have this feeling listening to In Our Time where when you're sort of like at least broadly aware of the subject at hand, that you just get a great deal of satisfaction having these people go through things that you like, you know, maybe like 75 to 80% know?
Oh, it's enormously pleasurable.
Yeah, you feel like a knowledgeable person, right? And mm-hmm. you feel such. So, like, I that's how I felt about the Lloyd.
I put on the Frankfurt School episode just to feel complacent. You know? Ah, yes, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Alienation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me tell you,
Horkheimer. yeah, no, it's every now and again there's one that comes up that I know all about, you know, and God, it feels great, you know,
yeah. In Our Time's episode on Emacs.
Ooh, you know, I still feel like I have so much to learn. The thing about learning Emacs is that like I just don't know enough Common Lisp, which is the programming language that it's written in, mm-hmm. To make it work. And I feel like to be like a full total understander. But one day I will, and it will be, you know, I know a little bit of Common Lisp, you know, and then Emacs is just like an extension of your brain, man.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, exactly. Like, the poor laws, that was really good. I felt really good about that.
Having English poor laws.
That one's very good. They rebroadcast the Gin Panic one recently. Cause I guess, unlike the talking show, Melvin Bragg and guests do not, convene remotely.
No.
I'm kind of shocked, you know. I would have thought that the format of In Our Time could have easily sort of translated, you know, like the BBC just mails a sterilized Zoom recorder to the various academics.
The way that they take a forced like summer break has always made me think that Melvin Bragg has a like he's treats work in an aristocratic fashion as a nuisance.
Mm.
I mean, he's probably a hardworking guy. Don't get me wrong, but he's just like, you know, work is something you do for the public good for a little while, but then come on now.
Right. Well, I actually have some facts on Melvin Bragg.
Oh, let's hear him.
He was born poor, but is now mm-hmm. Has been extremely successful, has had like a share of society controversy. I believe like he had a complicated marriage at some point, and is now, I think, knighted. So he's a real rags to riches story, but he's also very old. So yeah. I think there's a combination of things where it's like, one, he's an extremely veteran broadcaster and for sure only works when he wants to, and mm-hmm. two, I think, you know, if anything's going to be a hassle to him, he won't do it at this point, where maybe he would have before. But
I mean,
but
one of my favorite one of my favorite qualities of the show is you know, all of these are presumably leaders of their fields. You know, when you have the lecture on coffee, you find four coffee proper scholars, and they uh-huh. I imagine they generally command an audience. A captive audience, and
like
they're
in,
all kind of
in, right.
Yeah, like in their in, you know in, coffee symposium or whatever. but then here on In Our Time, it's almost as if they're all their heads are on the block because Melvin just cuts people off so brutally.
Right,
you know, if he finds
right.
them uninteresting, he's like moving on. It's a bit like a gladiator battle.
Yeah, or and sometimes he wants to direct the conversation in ways that clearly the entire mass of them do not want.
It's true.
Like sometimes he just fights the whole panel, basically. And like someone will loop back mm-hmm. and be like, well, I was just really interested in what Joanne was saying there for a second. He's like, so anyway, moving on to the whale. Yeah. Herman Melville did spend time on a whaling ship. And they're like, well, the important thing about the whale is this thing that Joanne was saying. He's like, so he spent time on a whaling ship. Then he was a postmaster of a small town in Massachusetts. You know, like just completely. He will not take. He brooks no resistance. Have you been consuming other cultural nugs while in Quar?
I've been trying to take my movie watching more seriously because we watch a movie almost every night. Uh-huh. I think during graduate school and before, I had slipped into just whatever is on HBO kind of attitude.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's not physically trying, but it is take effort to organize my Karagarga account and all those files, et cetera, et cetera. And also, I get so overwhelmed on Karagarga. And sometimes I download things where I'm like, okay, I'm downloading Out One HD, but then realize I'm never going to watch that. I have so many gigs. Yeah, you never know. You never know. So many gigs of things like that. But yeah, so I've been watching movies from the 40s, which bring me great pleasure.
Yeah, us too a little bit. Although we watch maybe like two movies a week.
Okay.
And largely just do TV. You know, like there's, you know, decades of Star Trek.
Sure.
There's like maybe half a decade of Murder, She Wrote left that we haven't seen yet. So, you know, just sort of committed to the sort of sequential grind. And and then otherwise, but yeah, no, definitely. I think like, what did you watch from the 40s?
Citizen Kane. I guess that's the 30s, right?
Oh yeah.
But
close to.
Let's see.
You're
what
talking
else
about classic movies. You've watched classic movies, maybe not periodized to the 40s, but like old Hollywood.
Right. And I haven't necessarily, I've been trying to go by actor, which I think is a bit more
fun. So you're
in
an Orson
like
Welles phase?
Actually an Everett Sloan phase.
Who's he?
What is his role in that movie? I can see his face. He has circular glasses and is bald and he's kind of like I guess Philip Seymour Hoffman towards the end of his life started taking on major roles, but he's a bit more of like, you know, like a really classy character actor.
Gotcha.
And so I've been trying to watch more of his movies and then Charles Boyer. I haven't started in on that yet. But, you know, these actors that made like 150 movies and I didn't recognize most of them. Most of them are probably terrible. But I watched Rebecca by one of early Hitchcock's first movies. If not his first.
Is Everett Sloan in that?
He's not. Why did I watch that? I think because I wanted to watch a Charles Sanders movie, and Charles Sanders is in that. He's also in a movie I watched, a Hitchcock movie called Foreign Correspondent, which I don't really recommend.
Oh, why not? Bad.
I don't know. I just, war movies from that period are just so boring to me and like don't capture any of the violence of war itself, you know? It's just like about how novel the telegram was or something.
Uh-huh. It turns out that I saw an Everett Sloan movie as well.
Which one?
We watched Lady from Shanghai.
Oh, how was that?
It's very good. It's weird. It's an Orson Welles movie. And
yeah, they work together a lot.
And Orson Welles is... And it's where Orson Welles starts becoming like starts giving himself over entirely to form. So it's a little messy compared to sort of something like Citizen Kane, I think. Where there's sort of a balance between narrative and dramatic and formal elements, and here, it's just like. Camera riot, you know. It's just like it's hard to imagine that he ever did theater at all. So in some senses it's very beautiful, and it does demonstrate, I think, like this great flexibility of Orson Welles's mind that I'm really enjoying in this reviewing younger Orson Welles movies, because we saw The Third Man as well.
That one's good.
In a thing that I think must be like a 1940s version of Tom Hardy doing the Bane voice and no one stepping up to just say like, you're making a horrible mistake, don't do it. Like that.
You know, we disagree on that point, but okay.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's in fact a masterpiece, but you know, it's one of those things where you would think that the way, like when you look at that still that was released of the new Dune movie that Denis Villeneuve is making, for example, you see that, you know, the market has had its say and we are going to have everything be this sort of like desaturated Johnny Ive brushed aluminum MacBook sort of look crossed with like light Oakley aesthetics. And that's going to be everything, you know, and that's why like everyone in the new Blade Runner movie looks like they're wearing like Muji pajamas instead of cool clothes, you know, like they were in the original Blade Runner, you know, things of this nature. So like, I feel like, it's surprising when something like the Bane voice gets out and in a situation where he entirely controls how this movie gets made, you know, to the point where he's like willing to have the movie stop making very much sense in lots of cases in order to like sort of advance his cinematic interests. Orson Welles decides to do an Irish accent throughout. And it's hard to go for. You're sort of just like, come on, dude. You have the opportunity to not do this. Like, let's just not do this, shall we? and you know, it's not the worst Irish accent. But it is also like it is also not a good Irish accent. A thing that was interesting, actually, that was pleasing to me was that it was very good at only using Chinese people to portray Chinese people.
There you go.
And I thought that was, you know, because for the time they would usually just like, you know, tape someone's eyes back and throw them in.
If that,
yeah. So it was a situation where I was, and Chinese people just speak Chinese is the other thing. Just like untranslated Chinese because they're Chinese. It's it, you know, like there's no like your people as mine. Like, it's just like, do you speak Chinese? You can speak Chinese to the Chinese guy. You know, really straightforward, just like there are other cultures. They do their thing.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I have like an interesting anecdote to add. So, you know, obviously this has become, and rightfully so, of hyper concern in our time, much more so than in Orson Welles. I went to a play at the Getty Villa about a year or two ago, and it was in like one of the famous Greek tragedies, like Aristophanes or something like that. And it was incredibly done, you know, and obviously a lot of the costumes were updated, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a bit more contemporary than Aristophanes would have done it. but there was a Japanese woman who was in the play, and the director had her do all of her lines in Japanese.
Okay.
I thought, what an odd
move.
It's
like the opposite.
I mean, yeah, I know. It's like, you should only perform in your native language. I thought that was so peculiar. but it was also amazing how like the testament to the play was that I still knew exactly like what her character was feeling and what was going on, even though I don't have a lick of Japanese, you know.
Well, the secret is that no one in ancient Greece would have any idea what was going on.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Like that's the funny part is it's just like, yeah, dude. The thing about that is you might as well speak Japanese because it's like English is absolutely nothing like Greek.
Oh yeah, of course.
Or ancient Greek. So it's just sort of like, wee.
No, it was a funny interpretation of authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, what would be authentic here is to perform primarily in English, except have this actor do their native language.
Yeah. And it would be great if they just did it in Greek.
That happens. I think like,
yeah,
you know, like
it does
period
actually.
Instrument performances. It's like it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there was, what is it like, like an Aeschylus thing that Stravinsky set to music, and it's like one of his oratorios, I think, or something like that, and it's all in Greek.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
During his neoclassical phase, after
yeah,
the war.
Later Strav.
Yeah.
I've been trying to, I think like you, I have good days and bad days. Yesterday was a really productive day, and today was not. I did not get much done today. And weirdly, now I kind of have a lot of work to do. Like, there's a grant deadline coming up, and there's freelance work. But I managed yesterday to read an Octavia Butler novel, or finish reading an Octavia Butler novel called Clay's Ark.
Okay.
Have you heard of it?
No, I've only read Lilith's Brood.
The whole, that's like three books in one, right? That's the entire Xenogenesis series.
Yep.
I have not read that. That's where the aliens and the humans do DNA swap.
Yeah, it's like a sci-fi erotic thriller. So that's, you know, that's why I got into that.
I see. So this is the third part of her Patternist series. And the first two books are like kind of like super meta versions of not the book, but Jonathan Demme's film adaptation of Beloved as books.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. And they came out before, so I mean that's a very ahistorical analysis on my part. But the it begins in like sort of primeval human civilization times, where this one guy who is a like psychic vampire, he can inhabit other people's bodies and uses up the energy inside them and then moves to another consciousness, who's just sort of engendered out of nowhere, presumably in Egypt actually. Meets this woman who's able to entirely manipulate her body. And she's in, you know, Nigeria or something, it seems, or what will become Nigeria. And they're both functionally immortal, and they live forever, basically. And so they keep meeting each other throughout history. And he begins this sort of, they begin sort of having two separate groups of people that they that sort of produce like their own mutant strains, etc. And I think that's what's like the plot of the first two books, and it takes you up to sort of largely the contemporary time, and then the third book features absolutely none of these people, none of these sort of larger social groups that these characters create, and is instead set in a time when the social order has crumbled. It's set in Joshua Tree, and a tiny group of and so I've read the first two books, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm looking for something fun to read. I'll read the third book, you know, just on to the next thing, you know, chronologically, in this series. And it's a tiny group of people in Joshua Tree who are who have caught an alien disease that came from a returned astronaut, and they are self-isolating in the desert to not create a pandemic.
Okay.
And I'm like, this is the book I read. Like, this comes on shuffle in the sort of sci-fi book pile. We choose to self-isolate during a time of a plague when the social system in America has collapsed. This is great. In the book, like a doctor who lives in a walled city is traveling with his daughters and gets sort of like abducted by this like hill clan. And the reasons why are explained. But there are large communities outside the walled cities that the people in the walled cities just call sewers. You know? And like when I finished that book, that was the same day that like Nancy Pelosi showed us her freezer entirely of just gelato from Jenny's. you know, and I was like, oh, this is why you don't get free healthcare. Like, it's like you live in the sewer. You know what I mean? You're the sewer people. Like it's just it was just like a book that was and I don't know. I feel like everyone's talked about all the sort of plague stuff. You know, everyone's like, oh, yeah, 12 monkeys, you know, like Planet of the Apes, the James Franco one. You know, like everyone's discussed all the different sort of cultural texts. And everyone's very happy to think and talk about Octavia Butler. So I'm kind of amazed that no one was like, oh, yeah, she totally wrote a book that's exactly about like this, you know? Yeah. And it was horrifying because it was like painfully accurate. But yeah, that and I guess Orson Welles movies. I guess that's what I'm doing. So not so much films from the 40s, but just like might as well check out those that I haven't seen and rewatch the ones that I have. Like I've never seen The Magnificent Ambersons, for example. Yeah, things like that. What other? So are you're sticking to Everett Sloan or?
Yeah, for the time being, and I want to watch Pierre Angeli movies or Angelou.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I don't know. My knowledge of that time period in cinema is pretty limited.
It's amazing the more you read about it. I was reading about Rita Hayworth after watching Lady from Shanghai because she's mm-hmm. in it. And she had a horribly tragic life. But when you talk about these actors who made like hundreds of movies,
yeah,
which seems crazy, you know, even by today's standard, it seems absolutely ridiculous. But it turns out that like that's the way the studio system worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just showed up every day and they just put you in something.
Right. And like Everett Sloan was in like dozens of radio plays and television shows and theater. Yeah. He's just like probably working every single day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there were no like, it wasn't like he did a movie a year and then you just see like paparazzi shots of him in sunglasses on the beach for like the rest of the year.
Yeah, precisely. And I don't know that whether that's true of Everett Sloan or not, but it's certainly true of Rita Hayworth, you know, like, mm-hmm. and so, and I imagine it's very similar for Everett Sloan, you know, and for all these studio actors. So it's like
mm-hmm.
just an entirely different way of making movies. And many of these movies, I think you're right, are not going to be very good. Because like they simply could not have made so many of them and maintained anything like, you know, an interest or the reasons why they were made corresponded to a cultural moment that we no longer share as well.
Right.
So, yeah. Wild. Just like a crazy industry that existed at one point and operated in sort of a recognizable way, but then in an entirely different way.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's I guess it's probably a bit more like television now because there's so much of it. There's just so much of it. I feel like I have a good handle on what movies are coming out. But TV, it's just I can't even try.
It's funny about not living in Los Angeles because I feel like billboard advertising really tells you about television.
Right.
You know, like or at least you know that there's like you're vaguely aware that a show of that name with, you know, is it, and broadly speaking, is it like a thriller or a drama or a comedy show? Like these broad things will be apparent to you immediately from seeing like it over every bus station and billboard in Los Angeles for 1 week. You know, like mm-hmm. every dog gets its due in LA because the business needs to show everyone else in the business that they made the thing. But in Austin, they really just don't advertise TV shows all the time. So it's like when coronavirus set in and we were having like a moment of indecision, we were like, so what do we watch? And you like look around at stuff and you're just like, I've never heard of any of it. I don't know. I've not been prepared to see any of this stuff in any way. As a trip. It's something I kind of miss because it did help you to figure out what was on TV. Yeah. What other films have you seen? What other culture have you taken in?
You know, doing a few erotic thrillers a week.
Still in the 90s, like in the
yeah, 80s or 90s.
Mm.
I read somewhere that was one of the, if not the one of the most recent filmic forms.
And then it just went away.
Yeah, it's not. I guess it's not really around anymore. I mean, they're pretty intensely sexist, most of them. So for maybe that's good that they've gone away. But yeah, I mean, of course, it has its roots in Hitchcock, and he comes from film noir, which goes way back.
And there was a neo-noir boom contemporaneously with it that you either have to sort of take as part of that. Do you think that you can separate it from neo-noir? Like, are there things that are purely erotic thrillers and absolutely not neo-noirs?
They rarely star a detective. Which a noir film always does, right?
That's the way it works, because I would argue that, you know, like Countess from Shanghai is a film noir, but there's no detectives. You know, it's just people having shitty lives, you know, mm-hmm. and like being. I guess there is like a legal aspect to it. Like Everett Sloan plays a trial lawyer,
right?
Whose wife is having an affair with Orson Welles.
Ooh, lucky her.
Who is from Ireland. But
Now that I say that, I watched one last night called China Moon.
Oh, was that a little bit racist too, as well as sexist?
No, it actually wasn't. Perhaps there's the only relation it bears to China. It takes place in, like, you know, like kind of the backwoods of Florida.
Okay.
Ed Harris is the romantic lead, which is peculiar for erotic thriller. Michael Douglas must have been sick that month.
Or they wanted someone tougher or something.
Yeah. He plays a police detective, uh-huh. and his partner is a very young Benicio del Toro.
Cool.
Which is very odd, because I feel like Benicio del Toro is a strikingly handsome guy. And wears like some weight, you know, like he's a weighty, thicker kind of guy.
Right.
He's like extremely thin in this film.
Huh.
It's strange, because I feel like, you know, he like has maintained a consistent weight as like an immature actor, you know.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't call it thin.
Right.
I don't know. I found that it's like, I guess it's like seeing an old picture of someone you know well, and you're like, oh, that's what you used to look like.
Right.
But anyhow, he starts an, Ed Harris starts an affair with a married woman, and the first night that they have sex, there's a full moon, and he says that his grandmother used to call that a China moon, and it made people act crazy. So, you know, there's uh-huh. some racist undertones, but they don't even use that right. metaphor again in the film. It's just like, well, we needed a name, and there was this.
He says
this bit of dialogue.
He says this word. So
he
let's
says
use
these two
it.
Words near each other. Yeah, it doesn't. There's nothing relating to people from China or people who have immigrated to the U.S. from China,
right?
At all. Yeah,
that's great.
But it was worthwhile. I feel like the trick with those films is the ending, and it doesn't have a good ending. But, you know, it keeps you in there for quite a while.
I feel this when you're talking about seeing the young Benicio del Toro. That's how I feel about seeing Antonio Banderas in, like, early 80s Almodóvar movies.
Yeah.
Because it's like he's this established sort of elder statesman hunk actor now.
Right.
You know,
right.
And he's like, literally, like, 16 in 1980 when, like, you know, Almodóvar puts him in, like, and they're the kinds of movies too that he would, like, never be in,
mm-hmm.
Or that Hollywood would never put him in, where you're like, and now he's in like a raucous body nun comedy directed by Almodóvar, you know, where he plays like a cross-dressing, like a transsexual prostitute. And you're like, there we have it, folks, you know, like starring the young Antonio Banderas. He's playing a gay matador, you know, like, and you're like, yeah, he's not used in movies this way anymore. It is strange. Have you ever watched any Preston Sturges movies? Speaking of black and white oldies.
Huh. I mean, I don't have a lot of those names at hand, but that name rings a bell. Let me look him up.
He's great. It's been a while since I had a spell in my mid-20s where I was really into Preston Sturges. And so I was, you know, just per our conversation, I'm looking him up on my laptop here. And he directed The Great McGinty, for which I think he's quite famous for, and All Hail the Conquering Hero, and what else? Sullivan's Travels, The Lady Eve. But then like The Great Moment. But then some of these other movies, like The Beautiful Blonde from Bashful Bend and The French, comma, They Are a Funny Race of 1955. I wonder how those aged. I wonder what that's like.
Well, that reminds me, I really love watching the credit reels in those old movies.
Because they happen right away at the beginning?
Yeah, often they do. I don't know when that switched, because I feel like it's been 50-50 for me. Some of them, they happen at the end. Or maybe they show a few more at the end. Sometimes there's just the end card. Oh, I did watch a Humphrey Bogart movie recently that was quite good. Where he murders his wife.
Would you call that a noir?
Yeah, for sure. What was that one? That one was excellent. I'll look it up shortly. But there was a role that comes up in those old movies in the credits of Standby Painter. I had to look that up. I thought that was a fantastic job to have on the movies. And it was you just stand by with all your paints and stuff. And if something needed some distress or needed to be touched up and look better for the camera, so they didn't have to do it in post, because post was so much more laborious then.
Well post would never happen. Yeah.
It's true. It would also never happen. So they would just be like, all right, standby painter, make that look more, more shiny. And so you just run in there and add a gloss coat on it or something.
Yeah, it's like why they, I think that's why they ended up calling it art department.
Yeah.
Because essentially now art department is sort of like props and sort of like misc stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the cameraman will be like, it's too shiny. Can you make it less shiny? And you run in with a block of sandpaper and sand something down.
Right.
And it's not even in focus. It's just not shiny anymore. And the lighting then sits properly kind of thing. But you wouldn't paint it in because they would just mask it in over top of it or whatever,
Yeah. Well, geez, looking through, Humphrey Bogart's filmography is a fruitless endeavor. There are so many of them.
Hundreds of movies. Yeah. Speaking of people who are working all day, every day.
Yeah, it's got its own. When a filmography has its own Wikipedia page, then you're toast.
Yeah. IMDb, not helpful. Looking at Preston Sturges's, to just do this basic bit of research, because he was also in, I think in the business so long. Although I think of him as being a director, it seems like he was largely a writer. He wrote over 50 movies and then produced several, etc. Yeah.
Okay, the movie's called Conflict with with Humphrey Bogart, Alexis Smith, Sidney Greenstreet. Sidney Greenstreet, this is all coming back to me now. Sidney Greenstreet's amazing because I think he's usually the villain alongside Bogart as the, the hero. But in this film, he's a self-described Freudian analyst.
This is right up your street. Your Green Street.
also amazing because they ask him at a dinner party what that means, including the people who wrote the dialogue had no clue what that meant. But that was a popular enough job at that time that it was like in the early stages of brain surgery, saying you're a brain surgeon.
Yeah,
because they ask him. They're like, "So do you cut open people's heads?" He's like, "Yes, that's right. What Freudian analysis is." But then it also is interesting because it starts that trend that pops up again in the 80s and 90s, usually with psychotherapists or whatever therapists as they're called in those movies, where they have insight into the way that a murder would unfold or involved somehow in the murder, because he ends up noticing details about Humphrey Bogart's behavior that leads him and the police to snag Bogart.
Right. He's like, I'm a profiler, but he's not like that's the right. 40s version of being the police profiler or something.
Yeah. Which in the end, the detail he notices is would not take a psychoanalyst to to uncover. It's right. That his wife changed her outfit after she left the house, supposedly after the last time he saw her. And when he gives the account of her, the last thing she was wearing, he knows what she was wearing when she died. Which, you know, isn't exactly Freudian, but
no, that's just like that's just literally an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
That's how all those crimes are solved. It's like, but then if you went to the crab bake after.
Yeah. How did you know that it was a crab, that they switched it to a crawfish bake if you weren't there?
Right. But you weren't wearing your rubber boots.
Yeah.
So you must have dropped off your rubber boots and murdered someone on your way, you know. Yeah.
Right. It's not like, so you saw your parents having sex then in rubber boots.
Right, exactly. And then have you seen Equus?
No.
Wow. All right. Well, I'd classify it as an erotic thriller, but in a whole other register. You simply must. We'll talk about it next week.
Okay. Well, I have one question for you then. Uh-huh. Do you know this? I don't read science fiction books, and I know you do. So I wanted to ask.
I do.
Do you know the film or the science fiction novel Model Land?
Model Land.
No. Yeah,
This is going around now, right?
Perhaps I heard about it from our friend Christian Megazord Boltanski. Uh-huh. Apparently, it's a 600-page sci-fi epic written by Tyra Banks.
Yes.
You know, it seemed like perhaps a joke or, you know, like something like that. But from my cursory Google search, it seems like quite an endeavor.
I mean, she made a whole website for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hats off to her.
You know, that's cool, writing a book.
Yeah, definitely.
I haven't done it yet.
Yet. Well, you wrote that book, Brian. That's a little
yeah,
book.
Yeah, it's a little book.
Yeah.
You know, this
You've
is
written a big book.
This is a 575-page book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you should do it Chris Carlton style, you know, the Grand Papier. Giant sheet of paper, just a little bit of text in the middle. It's really the only way, I think.
Yeah, right. It's better for your readers. I feel like
so much marginalia.
I've been reading these Renee Gladman Ravikian books, I guess, which are sort of very, very soft sci-fi. Largely, I would say, just sort of like a.
What does that mean? Like someone has a modem or something?
So, all right. Since you had acknowledged that you don't do lots of this kind of reading, the soft side, the soft versus the hard, is where the plot is dependent on the science or not.
I see.
So
like what's his name? Solomon Bothwell likes the hard stuff.
Generally, yeah, exactly.
Whenever he texts me, it's always like very complex, like contemporary physics questions. I'm like, he's just reading a sci-fi book.
Yeah, exactly. And so like they'll make some modification. They'll be like, but what if that thing worked like this?
Right.
Or there's a thing that's unsolved or unknown, and what if it was known? Then what would the ramifications of that be? And then sort of playing that out through the narrative. And like Ursula K. Le Guin or Octavia Butler are largely considered, you know, more soft sci-fi, where it's like things are different. You know, like the aliens came.
Mm-hmm.
They have weird diseases that do weird stuff to people. You know, how do you feel about that? And so broadly speaking, I think from a literary standpoint, most people are more into soft sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And there's rare contributions in hard sci-fi where people genuinely sort of feel like something cool happened literature wise. Like I'd say like maybe like, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson is really good with the science. So when mm-hmm. he does his sort of large Marxist allegories, like the Mars trilogy, those are very he's at least careful a little bit to try and make it into a book, you mm-hmm. know, and make characters and such that are that kind of do more. And then also just like play out the social ramifications in a more careful way, I guess.
Right.
Then, you know, someone like, who am I thinking about? This guy, Alistair, geez, his name's slipping my mind, but he writes like maybe 4 books a year. All of them have giant spaceships on the cover. And that guy is definitely hard sci-fi only. You know, it's just like, isn't it cool that the fucking engine works like this? You know, based on like 2/3 real science and 1/3 made up science. You're like, that is cool. What are the technical ramifications of that? You're like, the pilots have to swim in tanks or they'll be crushed. And you're like,
so
cool.
So it's like, is Michael Crichton like a medium well science fiction or something? Because I feel like it's usually based on some.
Yeah. What is,
you know,
Michael?
Like he goes to like the whatever the latest science conferences are and takes the most speculative thing and turns it into a novel.
Although not anymore, right? He stopped.
Oh, I don't know what he does anymore.
I haven't. Used to be you couldn't enter a movie theater without Sam Neill starring in an adaptation of a Michael Crichton book. And yeah. Now, what a career arc that is. From Possession to anything by Michael Crichton. but yeah, you know, it used to be that's the way it was. And now you can't even find anyone. You know, what, did Dan Brown just step in and eat all his lunch? Or what happened? Yeah, I would say that Michael Crichton's a great example of like the most popular end of like hard sci-fi, right? Because it's like,
okay,
he knew something about DNA in the late 80s.
Right, and wrote Jurassic Park.
That was like, yeah, and the Andromeda, and like he does have, he's like, he was a medical researcher or something like that when he wrote the Andromeda Strain. Or something
there's
like that.
There's like the medieval time travel one about quantum roaming or quantum foam or whatever.
Yeah, he's not totally, you know, he's connected to it, and he's not and then his sort of popularity makes him sort of disreputable, right? Because like sci-fi has to be about like either the weirdest or the hardest shit, you know.
Yeah. I mean, his formula is pretty great. It's like here's an enormous advancement in our understanding of ways to manipulate nature. Oh, look, we screw it up again.
Yeah,
we grew,
boy,
too many dinosaurs.
Who knew? Yeah. Oh my god. Fuck. Anyway, well, my Zoom recorder is running low on batteries. I realize I should charge it.
Yeah, we've kept these people up too late on a school night.
Yeah, well,
they've got too many Zoom meetings in the morning to go to.
Enjoy your Zoom class tomorrow, children. Mm-hmm. Yes, a pleasure.
This is the talking show, and we are done talking.
Good night.